This is House Judiciary, June 11th, 1985, Subcommittee 2.
Hi, Susan.
How's your...
Please.
717.
719.
We will take a hearing on Senate Bill 719. Yeah. 77. 719 first.
Out of nowhere.
Doesn't mean anything, folks.
Hey, it's not
partial. No, it's fixed.
Well, maybe we won't take the state trigger first.
He's here.
You ready?
I'm ready to go.
Great. Here we go.
Promise no controversy.
Let's see. 719. Do we have a sign up sheet?
Yeah.
719.
719. This should be the last bill, Michael.
Ready to go, Mr. Chairman?
I think so. We got our roles organized here, and everybody knows who they are and what they are and what we're supposed to do. I guess you're supposed to tell us why 719 is a good bill.
I guess so. If I could be joined by my counsel, Bob Muir, up here, because
okay,
I get it over
great.
My head.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, this is my first opportunity to testify before the Judiciary Committee since the having sat on the other side for these many years. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 719, which deals with public records in two aspects, and I'll explain those to you. First of all, I would say that the major had, I believe it was three hearings of the Senate Committee in a work session, passed the Senate Banking and Commerce Committee unanimously, and the floor of the House on a vote of 26-1. So it has not, although it initially, I think, stirred up some interest after the Senate Banking Committee was through working with it. It was a relatively non-controversial measure. It has two aspects to it, one of them having to do with negotiations and investments that the Investment Council may be presented with. And that, the language that you're interested in appears in page 3 of the bill, subsection L on lines 31. And since it's such a short measure, I think we can go over that. I might point out to the committee, Rocky, that large capital L should be a small L there. It provides simply that the records submitted by private persons or businesses to the State Investment Council relating to proposed acquisition and exchanges and so on may be treated as exempt from disclosure. And here's the important language that we agreed upon with the Senate: when and only to the extent that disclosure of such records reasonably may be expected to substantially limit the ability of the Investment Council to compete for, solicit, or conclude the transaction. Records which relate to concluded transactions are not subject to this exemption, so that once the transaction is complete, all the records are public. And then I would refer you to page 5, line 8, which points out that no executive, well, first of all, the representatives of the news media will be present during the discussions, even though the records are not public. And secondly, no executive session may be held for purposes of taking any final action before final decision. In other words, we have to go into public session before taking final action. I think that comports pretty much with the way things occurred in the legislature. In other words, we frequently would discuss things informally, but if we were going to take a vote, we certainly had to, or be debating to the conclusion, we had to be in public domain. That's the first aspect of the bill. The second aspect of the bill relates to what are called monthly reports from our fund manager. These monthly reports are prepared by the treasurer, by my staff, and presented to the Investment Council. And they're the reports from the money managers who manage our funds. Now, there, quite frankly, has been, recently has been an interest by one broker in Oregon in having these documents released to them. We have polled our fund managers, and of the 12, nine of them were adamantly opposed to them, to the release of it. Two of them were opposed, and one of them said they didn't care. And there are different reasons that are different in their styles why some didn't care, but most were adamantly opposed. And the basic reason is this, that the fund managers spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of their own money to develop their research ideas and their investment ideas. They're reluctant then to present those to the public in a nice, neat package so that the public can trade on their ideas, either buying in front of the stock that they're trying to accumulate or selling in front of the stock that they're selling, or using that as a retailing device to call their customers and say, this is a wonderful idea, and we know it's wonderful because this guy that manages money for the state is doing it, so we think it's a great idea. If any of you wanted to get investment advice from an investment service, you would have to go out and pay for it. And that's pretty much the position of these fund managers. They have developed this information for themselves. They've spent their own money on it. They do not want to give that away for free. What we concluded, and this is not a unique problem, it's a problem that exists in the mutual fund industry all the time, because they obviously are buying and selling stocks, and there are a lot of people who would like to know what they're doing in the midst of their strategy. So the Securities and Exchange Commission has developed a rule which says that that information need not be released until 90 days after the end of the quarter, and that's what we are asking that you adopt in this law, that those fund manager reports would be released, but not until 90 days after the end of the quarter. Presumably at that time the strategy would have gone through its full evolution. So those, that basically is the two aspects of this measure. We feel it's very important to the investment council in order to continue to get the kind of returns we've been able to obtain for the city. And I would ask the speedy resolution. I would ask further, the bill came over without an emergency clause from the Senate. I would ask that you attach that to the measure.
Question? Representative Burton?
Just why the emergency clause, Bill? No.
To primarily relating to the disclosure of the money managers report so that that can become effective immediately.
Mr. Chairman, would you take a motion on the emergency clause at this time?
Are we listed for hearing? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move an amendment for insertion of the emergency clause on Senate Bill 719.
Representative Bonham moves emergency clause to Senate Bill 719, which would state immediately, effective immediately upon the passage.
Mr. Chair,
but
we're in hearing only on
Senate. So. Can't hear. Could I ask a question?
Sure.
When the in page 3 on the sub bill, which council informs me has to be a large capital L for some reason. But
oh, it does?
I guess for, so it doesn't look like a 1. Or,
oh, I see. It confused me.
Yeah. In terms of, will the public know in terms of concluded transactions, these records submitted by private parties?
There's three avenues of entry into the system. Number one, the press can be public, can be present at the time of the discussion. That information is in executive session, so they're there in their watchdog role, not in a reportorial role, but they are nevertheless present. Secondly, before reaching a decision, that's contained on page 5, before reaching a decision, that must be done in a public meeting. And third, and this is in that subsection L, that the records of a completed transaction are public. So there are three avenues to this.
What if there are there situations where there could be discussions? Well, if you decide not to make an investment, is that done in a public meeting?
Yes, it would be, because it would be a final decision.
If I'm trying to run some different scenarios, but sometimes do you decide not to take something to the investment council, for example?
If there's no interest in it, yes.
Or, I mean, I guess, is there a sort of a review process where a staff review process, and they gather this information and they present it to you before it goes to the investment council, and you say it's not worth it, or something come up in the stock market?
Yeah, it doesn't fit in the guidelines. I mean, that could happen to staff level.
How often does that happen?
Well, as a practical matter, we get many opportunities or transactions presented to us almost on a daily basis. Now, a lot of them are minor. Maybe once a week we'll have a major transaction. I'm thinking something in the neighborhood $25 million or above presented to us. But we get dozens and dozens of other kinds of transactions presented all the time. Many of them are just simply too small to deal with, so we just don't handle it.
What happens to that information?
Very often there is no written information. Somebody calls up and wants to know if we'd be interested in buying some mortgages from them or something like that. We give them a price and they say that's too high, or they don't like something about it, and that's the end of it.
Further questions? Representative Springer.
Bill, on page 3 in section, or new subsection M there, mm-hmm. The monthly reports that are submitted, I don't think I've ever seen one of those reports. Are they something that looks like a big computer printout that lists
some of them? Do, yeah. Yeah, but that would be a good description. Yeah. And it would show their positions and by fund manager. We actually publish that information now on a composite basis. Mm-hmm. But when you break it down by fund manager, then you show specifically what William Witter is accumulating, then you can pretty well read his strategy.
On the different funds, I know we've got PERS is probably the biggest, right. But the Industrial Accident Fund is also a fairly large component. Are those funds commingled,
right,
and several managers may be responsible for part of each fund?
Well, they're commingled in our fund. We're sort of like a mutual fund in that respect.
Okay.
We have the PERS funds and we have the SAFE funds. Those funds then are transferred to a fund manager who also, and some of our fund managers run on a co-mingled basis. It depends on their particular strategy. So they would be running our funds as really a fungible lot with funds from other public and private organizations all over the nation. And this is why some of them object so strongly, because they don't have to publish that for them, and if they were forced to do it for us, then they might rethink our relationship. Now, the one who doesn't care, this happens to be his style, he puts everything in an auction, a public auction, in effect, and posts it on a screen, and he allows 24 people to pay him a service to get the information off that screen, and then he buys and sells anything that's on there. So he doesn't care. In fact, he wants more people to know.
Another question.
Representative Springer.
Just the section above there, where the language that says that the records or information may be treated as exempt from disclosure when and only to the extent that disclosure,
right,
of such records reasonably,
right,
may be expected. The language here is obviously subject to a lot of discretion and interpretation. is that the council that's going to be making that decision collectively, or is that your decision, or who decides when we reach the point that disclosure would reasonably be expected to substantially limit the fund's ability to do all these things it needs to do?
I would think that that would, to a large extent, be done by the council. But as I say, there are deals that come to us which never reach the discussion stage. So in that respect, they may die stillborn before they ever reach the council stage.
Thank you.
I might say that language, we reviewed that with Don Sterling of the Oregonian. He's the representative of the ONPA, and that seemed to be satisfactory to him.
Would there be any problem with what would be the problem with adding a sentence that says that the treasurer shall, and perhaps this is done through your legal counsel, shall enter a memoranda to the file stating that on this date this determination is made of the necessity for this confidential treatment?
Really two things running through my mind. Number one, the period of where we are at this stage of the session, and whether or not any amendments will of a substantive nature are going to create any problems for us. The second is when that would be used, if at all. As a practical matter, now documents come to us marked confidential, and we make a determination as a practical matter that they are or are not of a confidential nature already. So I don't know that you put on a memorandum to the effect that the fact is that they are confidential, we treat them as confidential. The decision that is made.
I guess.
Bob Muir says you get an answer.
Yeah.
Chairman, Representative Kopetsky, in the framework of a public records request, Bob Muir for the record from the Department of Justice, the framework of a public records request, the burden would always be on the custodian of records to establish the exemption. If I were an outsider asking for those public records and the claim of confidentiality was being asserted under this provision, my first request would be, then I want the public records which establish that the records which you're claiming are exempt are the subject of negotiations. In other words, I want the record showing that you have been instructed to actively negotiate. And in the absence of any record showing that the Treasurer's Office is involved in negotiations, I would then probably challenge the Treasurer in court if the Treasurer didn't divulge the records. The burden will be on the Treasurer to establish the exemption, and the first thing the Treasurer is going to have to do is satisfy in his mind or her mind that there is active negotiation going on, because this exemption only applies to active negotiation. There has to be a substantial limit to effectively compete or negotiate for, solicit or conclude, and somewhere in the record there's got to be some direction showing that there's an active negotiation going on. So I'd go one step back of the specific records and say, show me active negotiation has been directed.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful then, and I think it's important to have that on the record as well for this, to show that where the burden of proof lies, and that it would take something more than the state treasurer saying, oh, well, we're negotiating right now, they're going to have to document some sort of, physically, more than likely, some sort of status of negotiation that is going on, and it's going towards concluding an investment.
And the consequences for the public officer, if he's found wrong in a court of law, potentially not only divulging the records, but the assessment of attorney's fees.
They got all the money. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any other individuals that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 719 that did not sign up? Yes. We can hold it till a little bit later. Is there a particular reason? Are you waiting for another witness or?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
I don't know if other members received copies of these letters that were addressed to me, and normally I try to make copies available, and I will if members haven't received them, but I received a letter from Stewart Director, Vice President at Shearson Lehman, expressing support for the bill. I've also received a letter from Mr. John McCaffrey, Vice President Kidder Peabody and Company, expressing support for the bill, and also a letter from John D. Ritchie, Vice President Investments, with Prudential Beige, also expressing support for the bill. And in the event members haven't received that, I can share it with council and ask a copy to be made for all members, and that these be made a part of the record also.
Thank you. And they'll be part of the record. We will temporarily close the hearing on Senate Bill 719. And Mr. Gary here. I wanted to take up 2154, and I will take it up next. Because I need to have some amendments copied. Okay. Why don't we do 77, Senate Bill 717. We have Mr. Henry from the Secretary of State's office. Good afternoon. Thank you. Could you turn the two mics, Cal, towards you? Thank you.
Come across the stereo this way.
Okay. Representative Kopetsky, this Senate Bill 717 is a housekeeping bill related to it is to change the law a little bit so that we would no longer have to keep tax liens which have been released by the IRS in our files. And all it does is really just clean up our records and remove that provision out of the code so that released tax liens are no longer part of our files. I presented you with a copy of a letter from the Internal Revenue, which tells us that there is no specific federal requirement that requires us to permanently maintain released or statute barred liens in our file. Under current law, we are required by law to keep them in there. And this bill just corrects that discrepancy.
7-7. Do you want a motion? Are there questions from the committee members? Are there any other individuals who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 717 that didn't have the opportunity to sign the witness sheet? Okay, Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 717 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Can we move it to the full committee first?
To full committee, that'd be a good idea.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bonner moves Senate Bill 717 to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation. For discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Kopetsky?
Aye. Motion's adopted.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Why don't we do a hearing on Senate Bill 588? Ms. Edwards, I think this is the first time you've not had to wait 3 hours.
Very briefly, Senate Bill 588 is the Uniform Limited Partnership Act. It was prepared by the National Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which is passed in probably half the states. Yet the Senate side, we had amendments put in there to conform the paper processing and fees to what we had proposed in our own legislation. The Uniform Act, of course, didn't establish those things. So the bill now does conform to House Bill 2222, which you may recall, in 2223, which had simplified our fee structure. Except in one respect, one error I caught, and I'm glad Representative Billamy isn't here because
he may be back shortly, so make it short.
Yes, sir. Legislative Council has proposed conflict amendments so that if Senate Bill 588 is passed, then the parts dealing with limited partnerships in 2222 and 2223 are repealed. And you probably have those amendments. And Mr. Barilla, I'm working, he has those amendments for you. As they say, they simply resolve the conflicts between those other two bills that we had introduced to simplify the processing. The one thing which is not a major change, and as I was reading it over here, has to do with obtaining the standard industrial classification code number. In effect, now when we get type of business, which we do on renewals of entities, we're now having them put it in that SIC code, which is kind of a standard code that's used throughout the country. What I notice on page 2, it's lines 4 and 5, is that we included the requirement for SIC code, or effectively type of business, on the original documents filed with us. We probably don't really want to do that because in some cases they may not have totally decided what they're going to do, and in many cases they won't have the listing. Elsewhere, we've simply required SIC codes on renewals where people have been in business, and we can send them out the information, they can select it. And as I say, I just caught that. It's not a major thing, but for uniformity and probably to make it simpler for the public, we ought to delete that. And that's on page 6. It's lines 4 and 5. And then we would simply renumber the rest of the sections. Other than that, the bill was reviewed extensively by a bar committee that spent about a year on it. Worked very hard to make sure that it was consistent with their thoughts about how limited partnerships ought to be regulated and still consistent with the Uniform Act so that we would have uniformity throughout the country. It was before the Senate committee, a representative from the National Commissioners from Chicago came and testified, as well as many of the Oregon commissioners that testified in support of it.
Representative Bond.
The staff analysis we have indicates that one of the changes is that certain activities, it's made clear that limited partners cannot carry on and still maintain limited liability.
That's correct.
Could you indicate those things that you could do under the previous act and maintain limited liability that you cannot do under the new act and maintain limited liability?
Yeah, Representative Bunn, I'm not perhaps well into the substantive part as I should be. What I think the difference is that the current law doesn't spell it out. It generally says that if you have managing responsibilities, you're probably a general partner, and therefore you probably have liability. So it's always a question, and then it becomes kind of a, you know, either up to court interpretation as to when the limited partner has crossed over that threshold. And I think the thought of the Uniform Act is let's try to lay those things out, what he can and cannot do. So it's not, my impression is not a major change in policy, but it does clarify that.
Further questions, Mr.
Representative Bunn.
I know that one of the areas that was an ongoing problem is you have a general partner and a manager, and then you have limited partners who meet and discuss policy and in effect board of director type of activities and say to the general partner, we want you to do such and such. Do you know how those limited partners, whether limited partners could meet as a group and give some direction or input to the general partner as to setting policy, or under this bill do they have?
No real monitoring until much after the fact. It's a very long involved bill in terms of what actually happens with divestiture. So it might be possible to add to existing legislation some type of monitoring apparatus. Other than that, change here there probably won't change too much in terms of this. For example, the disclosure time, 90 days, it'd be nice if that was 30 days, because what can happen is that, let's say a transaction is done on the 3rd of January, 90 days after the end of the calendar quarter would put it potentially the 2nd of July before that would have to be disclosed. So that's one possible interpretation.
Okay. Question of Representative Burton.
I wonder, would you, Ellen, you have a copy of the bill?
Yes, I do.
On page 3, the famous L paragraph, the large right. L now, is differentiated between one. How would you interpret, in your view, that who would make the determination as to what would be a reasonably expected, or what could be reasonably expected to substantially limit the ability of the council? I mean, who makes, in your view, according to the way you read this, makes that decision?
Well, I would imagine from viewing the workings of the State Treasurer's Office from a distance, I've never seen them in action personally. I understand that I can go to the meetings if I'd like, that the chair, whoever is the acting administrator, Roger Meyer, I think has been in the past for quite a number of years, and the State Treasurer's Office would determine that between the two of them. I'm not sure at this point with the State Treasurer's Office becoming much more actively involved in these sorts of things. I imagine that they would probably be defining the law as they see it in terms of administration.
Representative Burton.
Yeah, a private sector activity of this sort, would that disclosure be allowed?
It depends on the situation. Obviously, in certain types of investment, such as buying land ahead of time, for example, private land investing, the more the secrecy, the better, in a sense that you would, if you see a situation out there, an investment opportunity, and nobody else in the country, or at least in your area, sees it, and you can get the best deal possible in terms of nobody knows the freeways going through that section of property or whatever, you buy the property, then you tell people about it, and at that point the price starts going up and you sell when you feel like it.
Further questions? I guess that's the concern I got here, is that we ask a certain agency in the government to manage these funds. But aren't we putting them at a disadvantage if what you just said about private sector operations, which would be in a sense similar here, aren't we putting our managers at a disadvantage?
Well, it's a different type of funds. when you're out there risking your own pocketbook, if something goes wrong, you know who to sue. You sue yourself. I mean, it's one of those things. If you're a private land investor and you're working with your own private funds, and you make a mistake and buy a swamp land, for example, that they didn't put the freeway through or whatever, that's your money. And you made the mistake and you pay for it. With public funds, you've got a different situation there, in a sense that it's the people who contributed the funds, and ultimately, if there's pension liability involved, the State of Oregon General Fund might have to step in. I know that they've had a very good track record in terms of being able to provide a high rate of return. Now, over the past 4 years, the high interest rates have really been in their benefit. Or that they could, for example, if they bought government bonds at 15% or whatever they peaked out and just held them, it'd show a phenomenal rate of return.
Captain Burke.
I'm wondering if the concern here then is with the accountability factor or the disclosure. If the accountability issue is it. You know, you've got constitutional accountability, of course, because you have a constitutional officer that's responsible for this. But when you were talking about narrowing this down, are you narrowing it down in the sense of some more strict accountability in the sense of who makes that decision about disclosure or not? If we gave that disclosure decision to a constitutional officer, would that satisfy who had? Admittedly, they aren't his or her fund directly, but I would hope that he or she would treat them as such, since they're public investments. And
that's not necessarily a good situation to be in. Now, many people, especially, I'll have to sort of, as a personal investment broker, I am in a different situation than 90% of my clients in terms of my own personal investing, because I'm a single person, et cetera, et cetera. I can take phenomenal risks, whereas a person is married, has three kids, a mortgage, $40,000 a year income, they shouldn't be taking risks. They should be. See what I'm saying in terms of each, the prudent, there is no such thing as the quote prudent man unquote. There is a concept that is developed in terms of the best possible situation vis-a-vis the context in which that investor or invest group of investors, or in this case, investing body, has to operate. Now, in terms of whether or not they're at a disadvantage versus an advantage, obviously the person selling the deal either owns it or got there first. But the State of Oregon does not have an analyst that goes out looking for deals. They have deals that come in the door, they analyze them, and they buy them or they don't buy them. They probably negotiate terms, etc. They do not have somebody out there seeking the best stock, the best bond, et cetera, et cetera. They buy and sell them much like any other investor who is being solicited, which is a different situation, a solicitor versus a solicitee, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Just a couple of quick ones. How long have you been working in the investment community, David?
4 years.
I don't pretend to know anything about that world, but my sense is that people talk to each other a lot.
And tremendous amount.
There's an incredible trade in information, and I kind of sense that keeping a secret in the investment market in a town like Portland is kind of like keeping a secret here in the state capitol. We all know what that's like. So I guess this is more a comment. It seems to me the only ones, the real people that it's being kept a secret from are the public out there. Now, I don't know if you can tell me if that's true or not based on your experience.
Exactly. And ironically, I've seen more money lost in, quote, inside information than normal information than one would buy and sell in fundamentals. That's the funny thing about information in terms of, let's say, a board of directors decides to sell their corporation to the highest bidder. Obviously, if you own the stock before they decide that, you're going to make some money because they're going to go out and solicit bids for their whole company. Now, I've seen more people try to play that game one way or another and lose than I've ever seen make money at it, because they think they had inside information, their inside information is not good, or the deal changes so quickly that their inside information is useless. So that I understand the state treasurer's concern that if somebody brings him a deal, the information might leak and it might create problems for him, but according to the testimony of other people at the hearing in the Senate side, it wasn't as big a problem as has been thought, and the existing law has got us this far. So that's all my, that's my basic point.
Representative Springer.
This may be totally off base, but it seems to me that we have a lot, there's been a lot of attention lately in terms of, quote, inside information and the liability that accrues to individuals who are in a position of some trust and act upon or share, quote, inside information. Does that have any relationship to this kind of issue or this kind of bill?
I don't think so. We're not talking about the classic case of the printer that reads the prospectus of a tender buyout, a tender offer for a company, and it goes out and buys a stock, or the reporter for the Wall Street Journal that was tipping a broker on what he was going to write. We don't have that situation. Even Value Line, which is a classic, very upscale, highly regarded publication, people were reading the Value Line before it was printed and going out and buying the changes in that, and that's being stopped now. But no, this has nothing to do with this bill, as far as I read it. Now, obviously, the State Treasurer's Office might have more to say on this. I don't know. At this point, I'd like to see the bill continued in terms of being able to deal with all of this in total. And the basic point that I'm making is that the existing law has got us this far with tremendous performance. They've done a great job. And I understand that they want to upgrade what they are going to do in the future, but I'm not sure that this is the way to go.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks for coming, Bill. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 719. We'll move to a hearing on House or Senate Bill 595, and then we'll do 186. We do have a floor session in 10 minutes. And I also want to try to do a quick work session on 89. We have
Western School of Law of Lewis and Clark College. I and Conrad Hutterly, an attorney with the law firm Arap and Associates, represent the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar in support of Senate Bill 595. The bill is sponsored by the debtor-creditor section of the bar, and as we understand it, there's no opposition to it. What Senate Bill 595 does is give clarity and certainty to the law of fraudulent conveyances. The bill repeals ORS 95.010 through 95.100, Oregon's present law on fraudulent conveyances. Oregon's present law, which incidentally is based on a statute which was enacted in England in 1571, provides litigants and potential litigants with little guidance on how to proceed with a fraudulent conveyance action, and more importantly, little guidance on whether to proceed with such an action. Confusion under the present statute and the case law that interprets it exists in three main areas. One, the procedural requirements a creditor has to fulfill to bring a fraudulent conveyance action. Two, the definition and legal effect of the so-called badges or circumstances of fraud that have developed under the case law to show fraudulent intent. And finally, three, the length and starting point of the limitation period for bringing a fraudulent conveyance action. Senate Bill 595 specifically resolves these problems of our present law as follows. There is no requirement, as there is now under current law, that a creditor reduce his or her claim to judgment and attempt execution on that judgment in order to proceed with a fraudulent transfer action. Thus, only one lawsuit, not two, is required to both determine the debt and to proceed to collect on the debt. Secondly, the confusion over the definition and legal effect of the badges of fraud was resolved by Section 4B of the bill, which sets out a non-exclusive list of the circumstances of fraud from which a court may find actual intent to defraud. And finally, the bill clearly spells out the limitations period for bringing a fraudulent transfer action. I'm now going to defer to Mr. Hutterly to speak to some of the other merits of the of Senate Bill 595.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Bellamy.
Do we have anybody signed up in opposition to this?
Nope. Does anybody here want to oppose the bill? Okay. Do you have another question?
No, it's only late in the session, and if there's no opposition, I don't need a very long, lengthy description of it.
Okay. Be brief. With those marching orders, Bellamy.
Mr. Chair, person and representatives, Senate Bill 595 improves the existing fraudulent conveyance law in that it provides a roadmap for the cause of action. It nails down the elements of the cause of action, in other words, what a person has to prove in order to obtain relief. Specifies statute of limitations, the remedies, the defenses, and it defines the major terms used in the Act in a manner consistent with the Federal Bankruptcy Code and the Uniform Commercial Code. The benefit of this, it reduces the risk of unfair or frivolous litigation and reduces bickering over procedural questions. In other words, it forces the parties to get to the heart of the question. And the heart of the question generally in these sort of matters is, was there a transfer that was made for less than fair value while the debtor was insolvent? The current law is a subjective, based on subjective test. What was the debtor's intent when he made the transfer? Senate Bill 595 keeps this subjective test, but as an alternative adds two objective tests, which say that if you show that these elements exist, then you've proven that a fraudulent conveyance has occurred. Because as a practical matter, the creditor is interested in what's happening to the debtor's assets and that those assets not be reduced, not necessarily what the debtor's intent was in making the transfer. So in that sense, I think that Senate Bill 595 is more realistic than the current statute. And in the interest of brevity, I'd open to questions at this point if you have any.
What's a hereditament?
Excuse me?
A hereditament.
I defer to our law professor at this point.
Oh, don't do that to me. That's a good question. Under the current bill, that's what we have. We have all this language, which I think you're reading from our written testimony, which is on page 2. And if you read that, it's hard to know what the terms are. I'm not sure what a hereditament is, and I'll defer to any lawyer here, either amongst the representatives or here in the gallery, to explain that to me.
Page 6 of the bill.
Okay. I guess it's also in our bill as well as the old bill.
It sounds like holding in a test stage.
Is it defined?
Something that being held in test.
Does this come from a Uniform Act?
Yes. It does. And I'm sorry I can't define that for you. It is a term that is used in real estate law, and that isn't my forte, but I'm sure if there were a real estate lawyer here, they could describe it. I'm here.
Okay. Maybe we'll try to find that out, counsel.
Okay.
Yes. Representative Springer.
It's also used in our present act as well.
I guess, do we know when the Uniform Commission promulgated this?
Yes, it was this past summer, 1984.
Okay. The Senate Measures Summary tells me that so far, though this matter may be under consideration in other states, apparently South Dakota is the only state that so far has adopted the act.
Yeah, my understanding is that North Dakota is the state that has enacted it so far, but let me explain to you that basically, this Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is a revision of the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act, which has been adopted by over half of the states, and that was promulgated back in 1918. The Uniform Law Commissioners put together this act basically to clean up the earlier act, and mostly to make it consistent with the Uniform Commercial Code and the Bankruptcy Code. So basically, although it sounds, it's certainly new to Oregon, the basics of it are not new at all to bankruptcy law generally or to the majority of the states. But you are correct, only one state so far has enacted it.
Counsel, go
ahead. I'd like to ask a question, Ms. Travis, if I might. Does this bill, is it in compliance with the bankruptcy laws that are in effect now? Has it been written to dovetail with that particular, with the bankruptcy code?
Right, it has, and that's why it uses the term reasonably equivalent value, which is the same as what is used in the fraudulent conveyance section of the bankruptcy code, which is section 548 of Title 11. It used to use, the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act of 1918 used the word fair consideration. The change to reasonably equivalent value was so that it would dovetail with the bankruptcy law. And there is existing case law under the bankruptcy code to help explain what that means.
And does it dovetail with our own particular peculiar set of rules around the bankruptcy courts that exist now procedurally?
Well, I believe it does. And do you have any specific?
No, I'm just thinking about what the Supreme Court did 3 years ago and then the new rules that have come out and the way the district court is operating in conjunction with the bankruptcy court. And I'm wondering if this act reflects some of the general orders that the district court and the bankruptcy courts have adopted.
I don't think there'd be any conflict with the substantive law as amended recently in the Congress.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes.
It's not a question, but I want to advise the committee that there are some conflicts between this bill and House Bill 2164, and those amendments are being drafted and should be available later today when the committee decides to go into work session on this, if they do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 186.
Yeah, I think we better go down.
We have buyers here.
Quickly.
That way he won't have to wait longer. Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Carl Byers. I'm the current tax court judge, and I understand you would like me to give you a little input with regard to two amendments in 186. Is that correct?
Yes.
I think.
Do you have amendments to 186?
I think so.
I think, Judge, that you're referring to the Senate amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I think, I can't remember, it was Representative Bellamy. Did you have questions? Representative Burton, put Judge Byers on this matter.
No, it was on. Was another major of his, wasn't it?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Doug Gray, Management Analyst for the State Court Administrator's Office. The issues that came up in our first hearing on Senate Bill 186, pay and gross. When the committee was considering that, a subcommittee was considering that measure, a number of questions came up regarding the tax court statutory provisions in general. And both you and Representative Springer and Representative Bellamy expressed some concern about the fact that those provisions appeared to be somewhat out of date, and they hadn't really been brought up to date since the court was created in 1961. And you asked us to come back and address that issue for you, and Judge Byers is really here just to sort of discuss that issue with you today and see if we can't get 186 out.
That's great, and that's in Section 2 of the bill on page 2. And Representative Springer, do you have it? And I would like to address those that Representative Springer has.
Well, I don't want to take too much time. I've never practiced before the tax court. But we have, the judge had a lot of bills this session that increased jurisdictional amounts. We've reset the jurisdictional amount between district and circuit court. We've also increased the jurisdictional amount for small claims court. And I guess the question maybe wasn't directed so much in the context of this bill, but maybe looking ahead prospectively in terms of what kinds of changes we might anticipate in the procedures or the structure, if you will, of the different divisions. Apparently there's a small claims division within the tax court, which I don't know that I was ever aware of that fact or not, but are we looking at, or is it reasonable to expect that sometime there will be some reevaluation of how the tax court sort of structures and makes these jurisdictional distinctions, or can you maybe just give us some idea of what we might anticipate?
Yes, I might let you know, I've had some initial impressions since going to work up there, and one of the definite impressions I have is that the cases, a number of the cases, could be processed more efficiently and probably in the citizens' better interest if they were included in small claims rather than regular division, which simply means raising the limit for the smaller, for small claims. And we are attempting now to keep some kind of statistics that we can bring to you next time and give you an idea of where the cases are falling and why that change should be made. But I would anticipate, and I'll take a stab at some numbers, that we would recommend increasing small claims jurisdiction to say, for example, $2,500 for income taxes rather than $500. And for real property taxes, maybe $100,000 or $200,000 instead of $50,000 or $35,000. The reason for that is the cost of litigation has become so great that many people are forced into regular division now by those limits and are not able to afford attorneys, so they represent themselves. And they do themselves a disservice under the technical rules that are required in the regular division, which can be waived essentially in the small claims division. So, but what I have discussed with Doug and some others is the tax court statutes basically are 20 years old, 24 years old. And what I would see is some need to reevaluate those comprehensively in the next year or so and bring some recommendations to you with regard to smoothing out some things and making some things a little more efficient.
So
clarifying some matters.
Okay, so you prefer to just hold off and in the interim collect some statistics and come back next session?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Bellamy.
I see one of the questions I have. On page one, if it says if the tax court finds no undue hardship, it may grant the plaintiff up to 30 days. From the date of determination to pay the taxes, penalty, and interest. My question to you is, why wouldn't somebody file a claim for undue hardship automatically, knowing full well that they're not going to qualify, but they're getting an extension of time on that?
Well, that's possible, I suppose. Let me tell you why the suggestion is there. What we find is, again, most of these problems are not with the small claims division, they're with regular division taxpayers. And because of the technical requirements, when you're in regular division, of filing a complaint as opposed to filling out a form that the clerk gives you. Apparently people wait until like the last day before they decide, yes, I'll do it, regardless of the difficulty. Maybe it takes them 2 weeks or whatever to get educated as to what they think they're supposed to do. But in any case, most of the petitions for undue hardship, those cases, come in with maybe just 2 or 3 days left before their appeal time expires. At that point, if the court finds that there is no undue hardship, then under the current status of the law, there's a real question as to whether they can be in court or not. I have taken the bull by the horns right now and basically said I think the court has power if I find undue, no undue hardship, to give them 10 days to pay the taxes, and they're still in court. There is some view, and the issue hasn't been litigated yet, there's some view that the court doesn't have that power, and if I find there's no undue hardship and their time for appeal has already expired, they're out, period. So there's some risk there, and people who, many people do not know what undue hardship means. But it's possible, I suppose, if someone wanted to just delay the matter, they could simply always claim undue hardship. I can tell you that when an affidavit for undue hardship comes in, we make an initial review of it, and if it appears from the information they give us that there's no question that it is not an undue hardship situation, we inform them right away. If this provision were enacted and I found people abusing it, I would give them like 2 days to pay the taxes instead of 30 and make them start performing.
Further questions, Representative Springer?
Judge, would this apply, I guess I think of individuals, but I assume this also applies to corporations. In other words, we're talking about a tax liability for an individual, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, but in terms of a corporation, could we be talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars or amounts where a day or several days, we're talking about a significant amount of money in terms of interest, earnings that may be foregone if there's requirement for an immediate posting?
I suppose so. I can tell you that the experience so far has been that kind of the average amount owing in tax when people file these affidavits is in the neighborhood of anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000. We do have one pending right now where the amount of tax is $66,000. And I can tell you too that whenever the amount becomes of any significance, the Department of Revenue objects, and we have a hearing as to whether there's undue hardship.
Thank you.
Speaker's asking for our presence.
That's a nice way to put it.
Right quick?
Pardon?
You ready for a motion on
this? Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 186 to the full committee.
Representative Bellamy moves Senate Bill 186 in gross to the full committee to pass recommendation discussion. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Britton?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Petsky?
Aye.